Okay. The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. We have a quorum. It is January 29th, 2014. And I'd like to start out. There were two people I asked if they would please wait till today to testify. They were interested in testifying on perhaps the plan redesign. I'm not sure exactly what, but why don't we have them come forward? Ms. Joan Beaver. Is she here?
She's here.
Okay, great. And Mr. Thryden, why don't you come to the table, too, since you're next.
Oh, well, sorry. I see you.
1,500.
We won't leave you to the end this time. Be sure to get in your comments.
Thank you. He's
coming Sunday.
Yeah.
That's what
Ms. Beaver, anytime you're ready.
Sure. My name is Joan Beaver. I'm here speaking on behalf of Education Minnesota Retired. There are many ways in which public pensions in Minnesota could be improved so that retirees have sufficient income and don't need help from government public services or charity. However, I will focus on the issue of defined benefit versus defined contribution systems today. The greatest threat to a secure and self-sufficient Minnesota senior population seems to be the failures of public pensions, those that have been badly managed and underfunded in other states. Interest groups that wish to privatize many public institutions are trying to color all public pensions with the same brush. So here you are, once again, under pressure to make dramatic changes to a system that is, by and large, working well for Minnesota, economically and socially. A system which this commission has, over the years, handled excellently. Education Minnesota Retired supports a defined benefit pension, not only for public employees, but for all working Americans. Defined benefit is one of three legs of a secure retirement plan, along with Social Security and private personal savings. And it has been determined to be more economical for the employer than the defined contribution program. And I believe you heard some very interesting statistics to support that statement yesterday. At the last meeting of this commission, you were shown that the funding ratios have been improving with the sacrifices that have been made and the rebound of investment markets. You heard that while adjustments were needed, management of TRA and other public pensions is based on long-term strategies. Before the commission makes any significant changes to the current pension system, please allow the 2010 changes to fully play out. Retirees sacrificed 2.5% COLAs each of 2 years and now have a COLA reduced to 2%. And I think you saw at the last meeting also there were statistics presented showing how much that makes a difference in long-term purchasing power of the pensions. Active educators are paying a higher percentage of contribution, as are the employers. You saw that the SBI invested very strategically during the recession, which has also contributed to the funding ratio improvement. We would also like to point out that the defined benefit pension level in Minnesota is modest, is a smaller percent of state and local government spending than other states. Furthermore, consistent pension income played an important role as an economic stimulus during the recent recession, and you had some discussion about that yesterday also. Something like 90% of TRA members continue to live and pay taxes, including taxes on pensions and Social Security, in Minnesota. Finally, please keep in mind that the amount of work demands on public educators keeps growing. I have had discussions with three teachers just recently, teachers who are who have been teaching 5 to 10 years and are really questioning whether or not they can continue to do the job because more and more is added to their plate. Well, they are effective teachers who love their jobs. Some of them are considering looking for other kinds of careers. This problem is beyond the purview of this commission, of course. I bring this up because the privatizing of pensions will create one more huge task for teachers to learn, manage, and pay for through fees. So, I mean, I talk to these teachers and I think, okay, and so now there are people who want you to also do all the management of your retirement planning. So I think that's just one more thing that would be added to their plate. And that concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Beaver. Are there any questions? Okay, then, Mr. Schreiden.
Chair Pappas, committee members, staff members, my name is Tom Trinan. I'm a retired elementary principal from Duluth, Minnesota. I want to thank you for holding the interim pension committee meetings and talking about our Minnesota pensions because it's really an important topic. And thanks for letting me present today. I'd like to state my strong support for considering, and this would be a little bit, I don't mean any offense here, a change from our current defined benefit pension plan to a defined contribution plan for new employees. And let me say this. In a perfect world, I would prefer that we continue to have a defined benefit retirement option. I really would. But we don't live in a perfect world, and human nature being what it is, the risk of continuing our current system is, in my opinion, too great. So you might ask, well, what leads me to this conclusion? Simply put, at this point in time, we do not know the actual cost of hiring public employees in the state of Minnesota. What we do know is that our current stated unfunded pension liability is a daunting $17.3 billion. What this means is that we owe our public workers, myself included, $17.3 billion more than we have put aside for the work they either have done or are currently doing to provide important services for our state and its citizens. This is real debt that we are both legally and morally responsible to pay. Yesterday, some of our presenters talked about the risks involved with defined benefit plans, and one of those is the tendency to underestimate liabilities, and we have done that. And I use the term stated liability intentionally because the actual liability is based on a number of assumptions which honestly may be correct or may be incorrect. One of the most significant factors, of course, in determining the unfunded liability is the rate of return assumption. And as you know, in Minnesota, we use what is considered a very optimistic 8% rate of return assumption, which is going to go back up to 8.5% in 2017, which, as far as I know, it will be at the very highest level in the entire nation. And what that does is increase the odds that the amount owed is actually greater than that as stated in the most recent report. The effect of using an assumed high rate of return is that it tends to hide the true cost of the liability of a fund. And that's how a person could end up in big trouble like we are with the current level. So getting this number correct is critical as contribution rates and cost of living adjustments are both determined based on funding levels. Probably the thing that is most disconcerting to me is the fact that there is nothing in place to deal, to clearly address either the current stated unfunded liability or let alone one that may be larger. Another powerful factor that comes into play in a defined benefit plan is political pressure. And I'm going to bring up something that will be a bit of a touchy subject, but it was brought up by one of our presenters yesterday. What happens if funds are fully funded or nearly fully funded? In his October 2013 report, Mr. Martin stated the following about defined benefit plans under funding considerations, long-term liability issues. And he states very well, if a defined benefit plan is fully funded or even if the defined benefit plan is being amortized at a faster pace than the minimum under the established funding policy, that favorable circumstance will frequently become an argument for benefit increase. And we saw an unfortunate example of that in the mid-1990s, where the stock market was returning historical gains, pushing pension funding to 100% and above. In 7 short years from 1996 to 2002, with what I would expect would have been a great deal of political pressure at the time, retirees were granted pension increases, lifetime pension increases totaling 76.8%, a rate 4 times that of inflation, which is very different than the reality that we are facing here today. I assume actuarial models were in place at the time that somehow justified that action. And again, I'm not here to blame anybody for it. I'm just stating the political pressure that does happen. I don't think anybody looks back on this and said that was the best thing to do. But the actuarial models would have been in place to support that, I assume. But it created very disparate benefits for retiree cohorts, and retirees today are paying for that. In Duluth, we've had 0% increases for 3 years running, which I'm fine with because I believe in having a balanced budget. Planning for retirement is a long-term affair, and mistakes made early on have very serious consequences down the road. So what to do? First of all, you are recognizing the problem by having these meetings, having discussions, having presenters come in. Well, it's important to get educated. And I could tell from your questions yesterday that you are very interested in if we're going to move from one plan to another, how do we do that? And I appreciated you asking those questions. Let me throw out 2 thoughts for you. Number one, I would encourage you to move all new employees to a well-designed, defined contribution plan that will provide a secure retirement for our public workers, and take action on this as soon as possible. And secondly, the unfunded liability needs to be dealt with in a very assertive manner, regardless of what retirement plan is in place. It really doesn't matter. That unfunded liability is there regardless. $17.3 billion is not a small amount of money, and the current options to deal with it are already very unpleasant. The longer that task is put off, the more difficult and distasteful it will become, and the more difficult it will be to deal with. I don't know what means you have at your disposal in terms of study and propose action to address our current unfunded liability, but perhaps the state auditor, your legislative auditor, the state economist, along with some respected business people from our community, could be charged with that task and bring back recommendations to you. But it's something that needs careful consideration. The important thing is that action be taken now. I want to thank you in advance for your work on this important issue, which is critical to all Minnesotans, and thank you. Wish you the best in the upcoming legislative session.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And probably more of a statement than questions, because there was a couple of things that were brought up. I'm assuming the first testifier was here yesterday, and she heard, like we did, I believe, that from the Arnold Foundation presentation, that there are a range of variations defined contribution. And in that range, there could be crafted an option for people in defined contribution, not to have to do any of that selection hard work. And it would not require them to be professional brokers or investors or anything of that nature. In fact, I believe they gave us plenty of examples of how that could work and would work. In terms of the takeaway from yesterday, there were a couple things, and you mentioned it this morning in terms of our past history, and I've heard it brought up even in this committee, you know, regarding. We're better off if we're not fully funded because we don't make wise decisions sometime. Now, I'm paraphrasing, and maybe there's a little hyperbole in there, but I certainly believe that if you go back to the 1990s, that's in fact what happened. It was as much a political decisions as it was actuarial science that led us to 76% increases, and there's no denying that that has had an impact and led in part to the $17.2 billion that were underfunded given the Great Recession that we just went through. So there's absolutely a lot of wisdom in this. My hope is that there is some kind of takeaway from this and that presentation. I know the Arnold Foundation is a foundation that is willing to actually help with funding for states and municipalities to form committees, subcommittees, or whatever, to actually study how that conversion process would take place. And, Madam Chair, and I don't know, as we proceed from here, how the testimony is going to be received on both sides of this aisle, but I would hope that there's some urgency and maybe even some bipartisan agreement that maybe some kind of bipartisan subcommittee with some outside help, from the community in regards to all the stakeholders being formed so that we could fully consider this option and bring back a recommendation to this committee about how we move forward. We have an obligation to the teachers of the state to have a pension system that in 30 or 40 years, when we're all dead and gone, is here and providing a level of security that I don't know that we can presently say that we all feel is there. That's both sides of that. I mean, that in terms of stakeholders are going to have different opinions on that. But I appreciate both of those folks this morning. I unfortunately had a meeting I needed to get to, so I couldn't stay to the end and provide additional comments. But I think we've had a window into a real chance or an opportunity to begin looking at where we need to go. All those other states that have moved in that direction, there's got to be some wise folks there. You're going to hold a convention of such next August, and I encourage the members here to get more engaged, more involved. Even if you're not a pension wonk or a nerd, that gets into numbers, you owe it to your constituents and the people that work in the public sector to give them the best possible outcome that we can. Thank you.
Representative Benson, we did have the plans contract for a study on what would be involved to transition to a hybrid model. Maybe we should bring that back and take a look at it again. My recollection is that there were a lot of transition costs involved, and that wasn't resolved. And I know the speaker yesterday from the Arnold Foundation has written a paper about transition costs that we can take a look at. But it didn't look very promising based on the study, but we can certainly bring the study back and analyze it and see if we need more work on that.
Madam Chair, I think there was ample evidence from yesterday's testimony, and I think if the Arnold Foundation has been in this all over the country for that those transition costs to be questioned, and that we can really nail down what it would really be if we spend a little bit more time on it. So I'd more than welcome the bringing that study back up and having additional experts come in and dissect the study to find out how much of it is really factual.
It might have been more engaging yesterday if we'd had a debate between Mr. McGee and Ms. Oakley, because she did kind of contradict a lot of what he said, and it might have been interesting if, then he had responded and we'd asked questions. Maybe we should change the legislative structure here into more of a debate format.
And Madam Chair, I only stayed for the first few minutes, but it didn't take very long for me to learn that the opening slides of her presentation would be diametrically opposed to the previous presenter. So thank you.
Madam Chair.
Any questions? Senator Johnson.
Yes, and I'm wondering, you're talking about setting up another committee or something to look at alternatives. Has anyone done any study about the number of people that will be living in poverty if we go to a defined contribution plan? Because it's pretty clear that people do not save on their own very well, and they don't know how to manage. Because like most of us, myself I'm talking about, it's very difficult for me to play the stock market. I don't like it when I see my money dropping way down, and yet I know that's what happens in the stock market. There are many people that don't know the nuances of investing, and they will not have the critical information needed to do it. We'll have many, many, many more people in poverty when they get old, and you know who's going to pay for that then. It will be the state. So we should have a study that would indicate that what cost it would be to the state to have 50% of your retirees living in poverty and counting on social programs provided by the government. That, I think, is an important topic that we have to talk about here because it is our responsibility. It is not – you can say you are not blaming anybody, but I say we take the blame. If we respond to political pressure and make wrong decisions, mm-hmm. that's our fault. That's no one else's. And that's what I think we need to be looking at.
Madam Chair.
I don't mean to talk a long time about this, and I think we should let everyone share.
I guess I would assume that Senator Johnson is speaking to public employees because that's with the purview of the committee. Speak to this the issue of all the people that will be in poverty. The state, as public employees of the districts in the state, they have the ability to control. So there shouldn't be anybody that would remain in poverty unless we don't do our job, and we allow for this system as it currently is to continue to lose money. So the idea behind the conversation is design the appropriate a vehicle or mechanism by which we can guarantee that they don't fall into that. And as I explained before in the previous testifier's comments, you can craft a defined contribution where there is no real money management. You can maybe make some picks. There are many illustrations by which the money that goes in is still managed by professionals, and the fees are very minimal as long as they're contracted in that way. So there isn't any danger of public employees being paupers, on the streets, unless we don't do our jobs correctly.
Madam Chair, I promise
Senator Johnson.
If I might. Thank you. I'm not talking just about public employees. The public employees and what we do here at the state influences what happens in private. I know that, and I think you know that, as well as salaries and so forth. We are setting a standard for the state, what we do here for the private employees, too, and I promise not to say any more.
Well, thank you for those comments, and thank you for your testimony. We need to move on now to number three on our agenda, which is the membership inclusions and exclusions issue. And we're going to start out, Mr. Martin, would you just kind of summarize some of the high points of your memo?
Members, if you remember, this is the third time that the commission has looked at this topic. When we started off, we identified that there are really two things going on in this topic. One is a fairly narrow question about the public employees, our retirement association, and the minimum threshold salary for membership inclusion in PERA. And that topic is apparently been or is being thrashed about by the interested parties. And we can hear from Ms. Vanek about the resolution of that topic. PERA was directed to create prepare a report for the commission and has done so on the options for addressing that threshold question. And we heard the question of that top presentation of that report earlier. So part one of your memo, and the memo is broken into two parts and it's clipped together. Part one has to do with the PERA minimum salary threshold. What's being passed out right now is a further refinement or adaptation of the PERA minimum salary threshold proposal that PERA has come up with in the last week or so. So that's in addition to part one of the memo. Part two has to do with the broader question of membership inclusions and exclusions in Minnesota public pension plans. And the commission has spent most of its time in this topic on part one, not part two. If there's interest in pursuing a general cleanup of and reorganization of the inclusion and exclusion provisions, that's what's presented in part two. I think at this point it would be good to have Ms. Vanek come to the testimony table and brief us as to where her conversations with outside parties related to part one of the topic currently lie and proceed from there.
I guess anytime we can kind of clean up the statutes and make it easier for people to understand, we should go ahead and do that. So, if Mr. Martin, if you think there's nothing in part two that's controversial or changing policy.
I'll cover part two briefly when you get done with part one.
All right.
Part two is not intended to be controversial, but there are a couple of items I do want to point out to you.
And I just wanted to point out to members, we don't often, and we should more, to pay attention to our pension policy principles. Mm-hmm. I know former Senator Ann Lynch was very good when she was on the Pension Commission of reminding us of our principles, and we do have a plan during the interim to take a new look at them. But Mr. Martin has helped us out here on his memo, part one, on the first page under number two. He quotes the Commission's pension policy principle: to the extent possible, membership in a public pension plan should be mandatory for the personnel employed on a recurring or regular basis. And as just to follow up with what Senator Johnson was saying, we do really have a pension crisis in our country where we don't have enough people who are covered by pensions, and Social Security is not going to be adequate for them when they retire. It's just going to be a bare minimum for them. And as why do we have exclusions at all? Why not have everyone covered by pensions? And I know that's going in kind of the opposite direction to what Representative O'Driscoll's bill and Senator Rosen's bill was doing, but I do want us to have a serious conversation. And I hate to throw this at Ms. Vanek because we did not discuss this, but it did occur to me in a kind of step taking a step backwards that why do we have exclusions at all? So with that, Ms. Vanek.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Mary Vanek. I'm the Executive Director of PERA. I would just like to recap quickly the chain of events that brought us here today. Legislation was introduced by Representative O'Driscoll to raise our salary threshold from $425 a month to something over $700 a month in one fell swoop, and to adjust that annually, whether up or down, by CPI measurements. When we saw that, we thought that was pretty drastic to go that high that quickly, and adjusting annually was just administratively onerous. No predictability whatsoever in determining who should be enrolled. So we asked if we could take a look at it from a broader perspective. The legislation in 2012 directed us to deliver the study by February 15th of 2013, which we did. It included a survey of employers to just gauge an interest, to gauge what their interest was in modifying the rules and what administrative issues they were concerned about under our current system. We did discuss with key employee representatives in January and August of 2013 what we had come up with, and I can tell you we reached no consensus. So when we presented to you, we said we'd still like to work some more with those folks. What we came up with were four options. One would have taken the higher threshold and implemented that immediately, as proposed in Representative O'Driscoll's bill. We proposed maybe just bringing our threshold up by $100 a month. We proposed annualizing the earnings threshold that we would use to determine eligibility, and we looked at hours worked as a possibility. The most preferred by the folks that we interacted with was to annualize the earnings limit. The hourly threshold didn't really solve the problem of ongoing regular monthly monitoring, and that is part of the problem with our current methodology, where you have large employers that have a centralized payroll processing unit, and they have somebody coded as not para-eligible, and yet they go over the $425 a month. There can be some considerable period of time that goes by before that is caught, and then there have to be past due contributions made up. It is onerous for the employers and for the employees to understand what is it that indicates when I get pension coverage. So we preferred to go to an annualized earning threshold, and we would use a fiscal year or calendar year for those people who work regular 12-month cycle, and the school year for those who work just the school term, such as the paraprofessionals. The thresholds that we initially recommended were based on $525 a month, increasing our current threshold $100 and then annualizing that. And then 73% of that would be apply to schools. So it was $6,300 for the full year and $4,600 for school term employees. After some additional discussion, we offered to bring that down a bit to $6,000 annually and $4,400 for the school term. Why annualize these earnings? As I mentioned, it would be much easier to monitor than monthly monitoring. People would know when they are hired, what is expected. They're going to work more than 6 months in a part-time position, and their annual earnings are projected to be over those levels. They would be enrolled immediately. If they don't exceed those annual earnings, if it's not anticipated that they are going to exceed those annual earnings, they are not enrolled. They are given a document that explains why they're not enrolled and that explains when in the future they would be enrolled if they exceed those limits. And then we're proposing an automatic escalator that would apply, so we are not back here in several years having this discussion again. I think it's important to note when Mr. Martin talks about the varying exclusions and inclusions across the three statewide retirement systems, it's important to understand that PARA is not like the others. We cover local government. The variety of jobs that are used to provide service in local government are many. And we don't have one primary collective bargaining group representing our employees, such as TRA. We don't have a handful. I don't know how many are in MSRS, but it's fewer than are representing people in PERA. So when it comes to trying to get everybody in the room and getting an understanding, here's an idea of 140,000 people in our general plan are represented, some by Ed Minnesota for paraprofessionals in the school district, some by SEIU for school district employees in a variety of positions. The Minnesota School Employees Association represents school employees. Council 65 represents about 13,000 government employees in local government, both school, city, and county. Or all three. Council 5 represents a number of PERA members, many of whom earn more than the threshold, and it's not as significant an issue for them because they will qualify for membership given the positions they cover. We have the Teamsters that represent public safety, correctional, and general employees. We have a new group called the Minnesota Public Employee Association. I don't know much about them, but I know that they are representing more and more public employees. And then we have law enforcement personnel who are represented by, and fire, who are represented by any number of different bargaining groups, and many folks who are not represented. Mm-hmm. So to get a consensus on what's the right direction to take, I think really takes us to all sit down and think, what is a reasonable policy direction?
Ms. Vanek, then what's your vesting period with all these different? Does the vesting period vary from group to group too?
Madam Chair, anyone in the general plan who was in the plan before July 1st, 2010, it was 3 years. Mm-hmm. Now it's 5 years if they're newly hired. Police and fire, it's... For a period, it was graded between 5 and 10 years. In the 2013 session, we made that a graded vesting, 50% fund, 50% vested at 10 years, up to 20 years to full vesting, and our correctional plan has the graded vesting. It's a variety of vesting requirements, another area we might want to visit someday. Mm-hmm. But my point is that given the number of different groups that we are engaged with, consensus isn't always attainable, and I apologize for that. Maybe I could have worked a little harder, but it became very clear early on that there was just some difference in opinion on making a change whatsoever. We are recommending in Amendment LCPR 14-020 that we use a threshold of, or an annual threshold, as I got to keep all these straight because we've had so many varieties or variations on the theme here. That was the one where we were originally saying let's use $6,000 and $4,400. then we thought, well, maybe a better starting point is an LCPR 14020-1A, which was handed out to you. It's just take the current annual threshold of 425, annualize that. So for 12-month employees, that would be 5,100, and for school district employees, that would be 3,800. Now, I know that doesn't fully address Representative O'Driscoll's concern, but I think it does take care of one thing that he was concerned about, where an individual may be working very part-time, pick up some extra hours to fill in for a colleague, go over 425 once, and then never go over it again. But once exceeding 425, they're enrolled in para and they continue in the plan, whether they never exceed that threshold again. Annualized threshold is a little bit easier to manage and monitor. It also gives the employees an indication of what is it that's going to allow them participation in PERA. I can tell you that the Board of Trustees and the para staff wholeheartedly support that people should have pension coverage. But there also is a reasonableness here that needs to make it easier for people to understand when they get that pension coverage, for employers to understand when they have to enroll people, and having to go back and play catch-up, which we do in many circumstances, makes it very onerous. And if people are left unreported for a considerable amount of time, the employer pays all but 60 days of that lost credit. So there are a number of issues that the annualized earnings would help. It doesn't solve everything, but it does get us going in a better direction.
Ms. Vanek, wouldn't it be easier and more transparent if people just had pension coverage from day one?
Madam Chair.
What's the problem with that?
We actually supported that in 2001. We were successful in passing legislation that only excluded temporary and seasonal people in some specific groups that are already in our law. And everybody would have been enrolled, and we would have prorated service credit. Because of the time to program to administer that, both on our part and local government's part, we asked for a year delay in implementation. So when the next session started in 2002, that provision was immediately repealed. Because there wasn't support by some individuals after seeing that it had passed. I know they didn't support it when it went through. That was a very different legislative session. It got into the bill, and then it was immediately repealed. So we believed, following the principles, that people, everybody should be enrolled, but that we should prorate service credit. One thing I would caution everyone on that I have observed over the years since we initiated that, is that we do have a lot of very, very low-paid people. I shouldn't emphasize so very, very, but they are lower paid than your typical state employees. And if you prorate service credit, there's the possibility it takes them twice as long to vest and that their benefits half the value that it would be under our current system. So there are drawbacks to doing that in a structure such as ours also. But in line with the principle.
Drawbacks are they take them longer to vest and they don't make much money?
Takes them longer to vest because if they're under half time, 12 months of working at under half time is only 6 months of credited service. And therefore, 6 months of credited service means a lesser benefit, because the formula is driven by years of service.
That was what you did in 2001. You prorated, but it's not current law.
That's correct, Madam Chair. It was repealed in 2002 before we implemented it.
So current law, though, does not have proration for under part-time?
Madam Chair, current law does not have proration.
For part-time. Yeah.
So
we wouldn't have to do that. If we were to move ahead to eliminate exclusions, except for what you mentioned, you know, very temporary seasonal people, which I'm not sure we should have any exclusions. I mean, am I being really too radical here to say people need to have pensions? No, it's in our principles. I mean, we're talking about people don't save for their retirement. And these are very low-income people who are the most likely not to be saving for their retirement because they don't have the money to do it.
Madam Chair, I think we'd have to look at carefully. I think we'd have to consider what kind of What kind of mechanism would we put in place to address people who work very part-time and then all of a sudden go to full-time just before retirement? The Ohio Public Employees Retirement System put in place something to address something like that. It's called a contribution-based benefit calculation, which is pretty ingenious, and I think it has a lot of possibilities. So if you were going to put everybody in and not prorate service credit, there would still be a concern about, as Mr. Martin raised in his memo somewhere along the line, that people working part-time and then at the end of their career going to full-time is a form of salary spiking or a form
spiking.
Of pension
I mean,
spiking.
Don't we have that problem in other circumstances, too, people working overtime to kind of spike their high five?
Madam Chair, we have issues that need to be studied carefully, yes. I would say to you as the commission that I would hope you'd give this careful consideration. If you look at our exclusions, you'll see that many of them were individual groups that asked for exclusion, trades personnel that were asked to be excluded. Elected officials are excluded on governing bodies because they're like yourselves. They are put into a defined, they have the opportunity for a defined contribution plan. We don't know what their tenure is going to be, so that was a policy decision made in 2002.
This group of people, though, who are excluded, do they have an opportunity for a defined contribution plan?
Madam Chair, no, they do not.
I'm not opposed to possibly a defined contribution plan. Shouldn't we be in a position of encouraging everyone to have some kind of retirement savings plan?
Madam Chair, I don't disagree.
And yes, our purview here is just public employees, but you know, at least for them, we should have all public employees should have some kind of retirement plan.
I don't disagree, Madam
Anyway,
Chair.
I'm interested in hearing what people think, if not now, the next time we take this up. Do you have more to present, or should we take some testimony? Mr. Martin.
Members, Ms. Vanek, in our role as being something of the institutional memory around here, PERA had just a monthly salary threshold before 1973. There was the annual stipulation provision added in 1973, and then it was eliminated in 2001. Can you give us some flavor of what the argument was for adding the stipulation in 73 and what the argument was when it was removed in 2001? You're suggesting restoring that stipulation. It's been not part of PERA law for a good long period of time, part of PERA law for some chunk of time, and then done away with. And if you could just characterize what was going on in the Pension Commission, in local government broadly, that led you to in 73 to add it, and in 2001 to do away with it.
Ms. Vanek wasn't born yet in 73.
Oh, you're so kind. I didn't start to 75. But I can give you, Madam Chair and members, a little bit of flavor about this. There was a decision to annualize the exclusion to stipulate that, much like you're talking about, Mr. Martin, in advance, that an individual would be hired and their hours would fluctuate, but they would never exceed an annual threshold. And it was $3,900, and then it went to $5,100 when we moved to $425 per month. And the idea behind that was to give employers some flexibility. But the law required that they stipulate that in advance and employees know about it. We did, as Mr. Martin has pointed out in the memo on this particular bill, we did run into issues around members being given the notification that was stipulated in advance, that it was clear to employers how to apply it. We learned that we really need to do a very, very in-depth education effort if we're going to move towards something like that again. It was eliminated in 2001 when we suggested everybody get enrolled other than a couple of very specific exclusions, and we prorate going forward. When our old monthly threshold was reinstated in 2002, I don't recall why the annual stipulation wasn't reinstated, other than I do know that as we read our statute and administered that provision, If individuals were told they wouldn't be enrolled under that and it was exceeded, we went all the way back to the initial month that they exceeded 425 and required employers to make those individuals whole. That was part of the problem with that because employers would do their best to apply, say to that individual, you are not going to make $5,100 in this year and therefore I don't enroll you in para. But if in fact they exceeded it, say they went to over 425 the first month they were employed and they didn't exceed that threshold until the ninth month, we went all the way back to the first month to reinstate their retirement credit. And that became very onerous on employers because they weren't doing a good job of judging that. So this annual salary threshold that we're recommending reinstates that issue, but we understand now what kind of education effort would go along with moving back to something of this nature.
Okay. Any questions from comments from members of the commission?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
One question for Ms. Vanek, Madam Chair. Did the employees resist being put into the plan themselves? Because the reason I'm asking and thinking is that, you know, you're making a very small amount of money, and you might need all of it if instead of taking $20 out a month or whatever it might be, that might be needed for your household right then, and they would resent. Was that part of it?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, it's a mixed perspective. Some individuals definitely do not want to contribute. Some individuals who, especially the women who are married to individuals who are making more money, participation in PERA's plan at very low rates still impacts what they can deduct on their taxes if they're in an IRA on the other spouse's side of coverage. So there have been over the years complaints about being enrolled when they only go over once or twice. But on the same token, as you have seen here in front of the commission, many years into being a public employee, individuals, all of a sudden the light bulb goes off, and they'll go back and look at their first records and say, I went over this. When I first started, you didn't enroll me. Why didn't I get that coverage? So it takes, even though we tell them annually on their statements that we send to them, this is when you were enrolled. If you don't agree with your enrollment date, contact us because there's a limitation on fixing that. It is years into employment before they realize there may have been a problem.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
And I think that that's kind of a response for the reason that we're so concerned. People don't save very easily, and I can relate to it personally because when I try to tell my grandchildren that they need, and they're, you know, 20 years old, they need to start preparing for retirement, it's kind of like, Grandma, you know?
We'll just inherit from you, Grandma.
Yeah. Yeah, if they would, my practices, it might work better for them. But I understand that's very difficult because they're often very low income, and they feel like they need that money, although I know if they put $10 away a week, they would do fine without it.
All right, thank you very much. Mr. Carlson from the League of Minnesota City. Oh, sorry. Representative Benson.
Yeah, just a comment, though. I'm kind of hoping that from this committee we could get a recommendation that we could move forward on annualizing it. I think there is a great deal of benefit to be brought to the pension system by making it easier and not so hard to find out whether or not an employee does or doesn't belong into the system, and that we could leave the idea of everybody being forced into the system to a broader conversation, because I don't think in one fell swoop we've got nearly enough information about attrit rates and many other things that would concern me regarding just wholesale putting everybody into a system before we know who they are. I would absolutely entertain it. I'm seizing on the comment that you made, Madam Chair, that you're not against defined contribution plans, that if we considered going in and really taking a hard look at some kind of transition to a completely different plan, that we then enter into a discussion about who and when and how, because I have a just a real concern with people who think they're going to start and they're in these low-paying jobs, and hopefully that will turn into to something later on, full time and better pay. But then suddenly, after 3 or 4 or 5 years, decide, now this isn't what I want to do, and all the money that we've taken that they needed for their monthly income, it was brought up by Senator Johnson, is suddenly not something that there is any portability to. It's in essence gone. It's not gone to the people that are that are relying on the system that are still there, but to at least these people. So hopefully from this conversation we can move forward with a bill, a modification of Representative O'Driscoll's bill to move in that direction.
Representative Benson, let me clarify, and Mr. Carlson, you can come forward, that I'm not against defined contribution plans for this group of low-income part-time employees. That's what I was referring to. Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to start by first thanking Representative O'Driscoll for bringing this legislation forward. Our human resource managers in cities have identified the 425 threshold as being an administrative burden and confusing, not only for the HR departments, but also for the employees themselves. And I know his initial attempt was to try to streamline that. And I think it raised some good discussion of this whole issue of the thresholds for qualification of participation in PERA. I'd also like to thank Ms. Vanek for actually conducting a very thoughtful study and involving the HR directors around the state from cities and counties, because I think in that you can see just how difficult this issue is to really solve. There's no perfect solution as to how we draw that threshold, but as I talk to our HR directors, we think the annualized version of this is a workable improvement that will administratively simplify the process of determining who should or who should not be participating in the PERA system. And Madam Chair, just a side comment about your discussion about involvement or should not everybody be involved. The League of Cities supported that prorated service credit concept back in the early 2000s when that was discussed and offered up as an administrative simplification, and unfortunately it was repealed the next year. But we do still support that proration concept as well. I know that's a more difficult one to discuss, and it's not on your agenda today, but we would be willing to look at that as an option as well.
Mr. Carlson, what about having those under 425 part-time employees contribute to a defined contribution plan with the employer contributing as well? That would be portable, or when they reach the threshold, would roll over into the defined benefit plan.
Madam Chair, we don't have a specific position on that. We're certainly willing to work with the collective wisdom of the Pension Commission and those that participate in this process to design something that does achieve the goal of making sure people have sufficient retirement savings. I think we all have a similar interest in trying to assure that that does occur.
And you do have some employees now that are in defined contribution.
That is correct, right. Madam Chair, especially the elected officials are in the defined contribution system. So with that, I would answer any questions.
Okay. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, Mr. Carlson, I'd like you to maybe help provide some backgrounding on the question that, or comment or idea that was asserted earlier about shouldn't everyone be eligible or be covered by pensions. What is it within the structure of the cities that you represent that would be burdensome, or help us to take a look at that? What employees might it be difficult for you to cover under a plan like that if we went from some exclusions to no exclusions? What might that look like?
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, that's a very good question. You know, I might have to explore that with some of our HR directors. I do know that per Senator Johnson's question, that we do get some pushback when some employees that don't feel that they're going to have a long-term employment in the public sector have to participate in the system, and they would rather just not. They don't plan to be there long. They just plan to use the job as a transitional job or as a job for some future employment. And sometimes the employee is the one that really doesn't want to be involved. Keep in mind that we do have a lot of members that do participate in both the PERA General and the PNF plan. We also contribute on behalf of the employees for Social Security, as all employees would be covered. But let me, I should get back to you on that with some more details from our HR directors. I think that would be the most efficient way to handle it.
Madam Chair.
Continue, Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, I guess I would just toss out some ones that come to mind right now. If we go with no exclusions to, we should really cover everybody who's involved in public employee. Summer rec program put on by the City of St. Paul. Hire some college students to be involved for maybe a three-month period of time. They make $400 or $500 a month in the summer. Their college students' money's withheld, get sent in. They may be on a career to do something else, be an attorney, be something that's not covered by a public employee. What about individuals who might be winter, although it hasn't been real great ice skating weather, there's a lot of ice, but probably people don't want to be out there on days like this, but you may have, again, some part-time rink attendants who might be college or high school students, again, looking for a job filling within their communities across the state. Would you see it being problematic for cities to have to track each employee, report that, and then from your experience, employees sharing with your HR people, I don't want to be involved in that. How do I get that money back? And just the pure administrative cost to
Social Security.
I don't want to quantify it in dollars, but maybe to chase $50, it costs us $500 in administrative costs on that throughout the system. Again, just making a point. I don't have those as solid numbers, but
yeah. And Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I think those are all very good points. There's some broad policy issues, I think, that need to be discussed if public sector employers are expected to make sure that everyone, even the part-time or the temporary or seasonal employees, are, you know, have some sort of a retirement system. There would be some administrative burden. I'm sure there's administrative burden right now in determining who's not eligible or who should not mm-hmm. participate in that system, as we're discussing with this very legislation here today. So those are good discussions to have, and I really don't have a good, strong answer for you right now. I will visit with our HR directors and try to get more input.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess the question I have, if we're switching, I mean, I kind of agree with the Representative O'Driscoll's idea of going to an annualized. He's explained it to me in the past, and it's been explained to me that, you know, one person one time went over. But what happens if the person 1 year goes over the $5,100 and then never works that for the rest of their life, and but then has and now is, have again is stuck in the para. So it's
stuck.
Well, that's how it's being portrayed as. And I guess that's just for a thought out there. The other thing is that I keep in my mind, we keep saying, well, these people get in and they don't want the pension now, and it reminds me of my one younger brother who went into the Army after going to college for a quarter, deciding he didn't want to go to college right away. And so, but he knew if he stayed home, he'd get in trouble. So he went in the Army to get try to figure out his life. And he was offered an opportunity, but that required him to have a 6-year commitment. And he turned it down because, as a 19-year-old kid, he said, I don't plan on being in the Army that long. Well, 20 years later, he retired out as a major. So that's, you know, and he looks back and kicks himself for not taking that opportunity. So, he had an opportunity to go to West Point, and he just turned it down.
And he did stay in the military.
He stayed in the military for 20 years, but when he had a 19-year-old kid. I don't plan on being here that long.
Right.
So when we say that people join, well, things change in your life, and you may decide that this is what I want to do, and by making that decision when you're 19 or 20 or 21 or 25, you basically may have precluded yourself from being able to retire with a pension.
Well, I think the compromise here is if we look at a defined contribution plan, which is portable. So whether we decide to exclude seasonal employees or not, that's an option. People who didn't stay with the municipality would have put that money aside that they could take with them to where their next place of employment was. You know, they keep the money. So I think it's worth thinking about. Anyway, Ms. Vanek, did you want to add something?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to comment to Representative O'Driscoll's concerns. When we recommended the 2001 legislation, we did specifically include temporary exclusion and seasonal exclusion to address the employer's concern about the summer rec program. We have a student exclusion. And so in line with the commission's principle about making sure that people who are employed either part-time or full-time on a regular recurring basis is what you have to use as your gauge when you set up who's going to be included and who is it reasonable to continue to exclude, because I think it is reasonable that the students, the seasonal folks filling in over the summer, over the winter, we have to have some serious talk about whether or not that is reasonable.
Okay. All right, let's move on to and bring up Jan Allswiger from Education Minnesota and Sarah Lawrence from AFSCME. Good morning, and if you want to just repeat your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota. And I wanted to update you because the last time I spoke to you on this issue, we did not have an official position, but I offered some questions for you to think about. Since that time, Education Minnesota's Policy Development Committee and Governing Board have taken a position in opposition to any changes to the membership threshold. However, that being said, when Ms. Vanek gave us another proposal, we are always interested in talking about possible compromises. At this point, however, our official position is that we are opposed to any changes. And
Ms. Allswiger, by changes, you mean raising the threshold?
Correct, that we would keep it. But then I would go back to the study itself, because what we have been, what was laid out is options 1, 2, 3, or 4. I think really that there should be another option which is on the table, which is to do nothing. And so I'm kind of surprised that there are only options to make changes, but there should be an option to not make a change. I appreciate the discussion, so I won't repeat this too much, but just I like that you have been thoughtful about the discussion related to how plans are treated differently, and it really isn't in line with your pension principles if para members have to meet a threshold and TRA and MSRS do not. And these are sometimes the lowest paid people in the public pension system, and those are the people that often need more retirement security than others. And many of these people are the people who struggle to make ends meet, the custodians, the food service workers, et cetera. We think that there is a difference in who would qualify in terms or who would get a pension based on rural versus metro, because a metro school employees are often paid more than rural. And so do you have a difference in how you treat people? And the big thing is adhering to the pension principle and treating people differently. The point about having everybody in the first day would solve a lot of the administrative problems, because now you don't have to treat people differently. If you are in, you're in. I think it is worthy of a discussion to talk about the seasonal or temporary employees. I think that that's a valid question. And then I will just conclude by saying that if indeed you were to accept or seriously consider accepting the para proposal related to the CPI, I would ask you to think about or ask your school districts, what are the average salary increases that the PER employees have received in school districts? Many times it's 0.5. It might be 1% or a salary freeze. And that has generally been the course for the last 6 years or so. But you do not have those salary statistics yet about what the average salary increase has been. But the proposal is to have the CPI be the trigger. And our concern is if you were to adopt that proposal, that the CPI is rising at a much faster rate, we believe, than the actual average salary of the people in para. So one way to do this would be to require that the school districts, counties, and cities just simply report the salary increases that they have received, gather them, and then use that as an increase. But over the long term, we are very concerned that the CPI could go, the gap could get very big. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Lawrence.
Thank you. I represent AFSCME Council 65, and we represent primarily local governments in rural areas. We literally have people in every corner and every border. And so I think that we likely have, of unions, the largest number of people who would be in this category of people that perhaps would not get a pension after a change in the law. If you look at Mr. Martin's memo on this, he quotes an actuarial study where there are about 4,200 people who would no longer be part of PARA if these proposals were adopted. And I want to think about, who are we talking about? We are talking about educational assistants, cooks, dishwashers, part-time janitors, part-time parks people, and part-time nursing assistants. These folks get paid the least amount of money in our public local government system. And they're the ones that then would be hurt the most by not being able, even on their small part-time job, to get something towards a pension. And sometimes this is the only job that people can find in some of those really rural areas, is to become a dishwasher at the nursing home. It's worse, the effect I think is worse on them if you annualize the amount, because if they're working in a seasonal basis, then they are more likely to not make the annual threshold. I represented a man who worked for the golf course in Two Harbors, and he worked about 6-7 months a year, but he got laid off every year. He kept hoping that there would be a vacancy in the street department that he could get that job, but in the time I represented him, that sort of option did not become available to him.
That was seasonal, probably.
These folks are doing what we want people to do. We don't want to pay welfare to folks. We want people to work for their income and to focus on work. But by changing the threshold here, either annualizing it or increasing it, we are taking away one of the incentives to work. I'm going to be treated differently. I won't get a pension if I work. Why should I work? I think that's got to be a question that people will ask. It is real money for these people. If you're making that low a salary, imagine how important it is to you. It's also important when they retire. You can imagine what somebody who was making around $425 or a little bit better a month, how much they're not going to be able to save for their retirement. They simply have to choose between food, heat, home, and saving for the retirement. And I can tell you which one goes first. You all know that. One of the arguments is we need to change this because it's been since 1989 that we changed the threshold. My reply to that is that the 425 threshold, by keeping it so low, you are essentially allowing almost everyone to belong to PARA. You're, in a sideways kind of way, following that principle of having equality between the pensions. Yes, para has a threshold, the others don't, but it's so low that essentially they're treated the same. So I want you to think about, when you vote on this or when you talk about this, if you've got somebody who is working, they're washing dishes for a living, and it's the only job they can find in, say, Little Fork, do we want to say to those people, because you're so low income, you're different, you're not worthy, and we won't give you even the opportunity to belong to the pension system? And that's, with 4,200 people, that's what we would be talking about, is we want to take away the lower income people's possibility of getting even a small pension. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We have to set this aside right now, but we will come back to it, and I'd like people to think about it and let me know what you think, in what direction we should go. And I'm going to jump to number 7, because Mr. Bergstrom has another hearing he has to attend to, and have Mr. Bergstrom and Mr. Vanek come forward. And is there any staff?
No.
No issues?
There. Members, in your packet on item 7, we have the communication from MSRS and from PERA. The state law in recent years has implemented or put into place a procedure for a formal recommendation of contribution, member and employer contribution rate increases, whenever the deficiency between contributions and actuarial our requirements grows to a specified level. And those provisions passed in recent years have just come online for MSRS and PERA, and they've both recommended contribution rate increases. And the communications that do that are included in your packet at item 7. There's some additional information being passed out from MSRS and from PERA on their funding status. Both of these, several of the plans administered by these funds, fund administrators, have deficiencies of a considerable size. And the commission under the statute has the responsibility to respond to these requests, and the requested response is to enact the contribution rate increases attached to the two letters on tab 7 is document LCPR 14-019, and that includes the language, that contains the language, the contribution rate increases requested by the two pension plans.
Why is TRA not here to include it?
Members, the question is, why is TRA not requesting a contribution rate increase? Their stability provisions, the statutory provision, doesn't go into effect until next year, I believe. So it's an effective date issue, not a difference in circumstance.
Okay.
I think the two testifiers can now provide.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, Dave Bergstrom, the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System, and thanks for modifying your schedule so I could go to another disability hearing. Yesterday, Ms. Crockett testified that read out of our actuarial report that MSRS was never going to attain 100% funded into an infinity and beyond, I think is what it said. And the board took action to rectify that, and that is why we are here today. So we have, last year, you took care of the state patrol plan, which now shows on a market value a slight sufficiency, assuming all of the changes are implemented. The judge's plan changed last year, and that still needs a little bit of work, but has made great progress. And then we have two other plans, our general plan and our correctional plan. For our general plan, we are recommending 0.5% employee contribution rate and 0.5% employer contribution rate, which would take us from 5% employee and employer to 5.5% each. For our correctional plan, we are at 0.5%. We're recommending 0.5% employee and 0.75% employer. And the reason there's a difference there is your principals for public safety plans have a 40% employee contribution rate and a 60% employer contribution rate split. So I'd just like to take you to the handout that we passed out. And this goes back to 2007, before the Great Recession. And you can see this is our general plan. We were just shy of 100% funded in 2007. And these are all on a market value. You can see that 2008 and 2009, we dropped to 65.6%, and we've made great progress. The Pension Commission and the legislature made changes in 2010 to lower cost of living adjustments, made some other changes to the program, and we are now, as of June 30th of last year, just shy of 88%. So we've made good progress, and our board is interested in getting us back up to 100%. That is what they hope to attain, and that is what their goal is. So if you look at the next slide, it shows the contribution deficiency. So we measure funding ratio, and you know that's one of the measurements we use. And then we also look at the contribution rate sufficient to get us there. So using the actuarial value of assets, which spreads gains and losses over a five-year period, the actuary says we need to have a 12.45% contribution rate. Our current rate is 5 employee and 5 employer for a total of 10. So it shows we're 2.45% deficient. However, if we use market value of July 1 of 2013, it shows we need a contribution rate of 10.8%, and that leaves us a deficiency of under 1%. So on a market value, the contribution rate that we are proposing, a total of 1%, 0.5% employee and 0.5%, would eliminate that and put us back to our goal of 100% funding. You can see on the next page the chart. So it does show, the green line shows if we do nothing. It's not that we would be in a bad funding position, but we just don't, we just kind of level out. With the contribution rate increase, assuming the 2% COLA, in about 2023, we would hit 90% funding and then go on beyond that. Now, when we talk about the cost of living adjustment, if you remember, when we hit 90% funding, that goes back up to 2.5%. So these, it could be delayed. And I'll talk a little bit about another board proposal tied to that as well. So you can see the reason we want to make this change is it puts us back into that upward trajectory. If we flip to our correctional plan, that plan was at 84% funded in 2007, dropped to 55 in 2009, and is back up to 73% on a market value. And you can see on page 6 on a market value, they show a deficiency of 3.97%. This plan is unique. In 2010, we made some changes. We lowered the formula for new employees. We increased the early retirement penalties. We increased vesting. Those savings in the future would amount to about 3%. So the actuary doesn't recognize them until they actually sort of morph into the lower rate. 20 years from now, most of the employees in that plan will have the lower formula. So, you know, we recommended and you enacted some changes that in the long term will drive down the cost of the plan. And we are recommending in this plan a 0.5% employee and a 0.75% employer contribution rate. And you can see again on the next page, the green line in this, the current, we'd keep going up, and the board just wanted to accelerate that increase by upping contributions at this time. So that is the recommendation that we have in front of you. The other recommendation that the board talked about, under current law, if we hit 90% funding 1 year on a June 30th, so right now we're about 88% funding. You know, so let's say on a market value that ticks up to 90%, we kick in the higher cost of living adjustment. So it just takes 1 year. The board would like to make that 2 years so that you would have to attain 90% funding for 2 consecutive years. And that would avoid the problem of hitting it once and then dropping it down right afterwards. So that is something that we would take legislation. Mr. Burek is drafting legislation for that, but that it's kind of tied to this because they didn't want to increase contributions for employee and employers trigger that, have retirees now kick into the higher country or higher cost of living adjustment. They wanted to add some stability.
And when you look at what happened in 2012, where the earnings dropped significantly after a banner year in 2011, you know, I could see where having 2 years would be a little more solid.
Yes, and that's part of the proposal that the board looked at.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Bergstrom? Representative Kahn.
Just a comment. I think the idea of requiring 2 years before increasing the COLA is a very good idea. But as we're watching these market values going up, you know, again, I'm the person who always says we don't want 100% funding, just having remembered the history of everything that happens when we have 100% funding. I think as long as we're moving towards it, I'm really objecting to a big increase in contributions until, you know, until we watch that graph a little bit longer. I don't know what
a big
happens
increase
if we don't
in
do it.
What people have to pay in.
Yes.
Okay, was it Representative Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you give us an idea of the cost to the employer? You know, I understand, you know, I'm on state government finance, too. My guess is that the agencies are going to go, we can't absorb this, and we'll be back before Chair Murphy requiring some kind of remediation or some kind of help, and, you know, in terms of. So can you give us an idea of the cost to the employer?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, the total employer cost among all of our employers is about $12 million per year. This cost to the state was about $9 million. We have U of M employees and Met Council, so the state itself was about $9 million. This proposal would go into effect July 1 of 14, so the agencies would have to absorb it or additional money would need to be kicked in. For the correctional plan change, was about $1.6 million employer. On an employee side, a 0.5% on a $50,000 salary is about $250 a year, about $10 a pay period.
Madam Chair, follow up. Just so that people would understand then, this would also be an out-of-pocket expense to the employees of about the same amount.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, for the correctional or for the general plan, it would be the same amount. The employer contribution for the correction would be a little bit higher.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Vanek.
Okay, Madam Chair, members, for the record, Mary Vanek, PARA director. Just a little background. PARA originally sought this opportunity to have the authority for the board to recommend a contribution rate increase. We were granted that authority in 2005 after several years of working hard to get contributions increased, and the small deficiencies compounding and creating much larger gaps. And so we talked through with the Legislative Commission at the time and the employer groups and said, would you support that we have authority to automatically make recommendations, and thus this bill. So PARA's contribution deficiency is on the front. The PARA general plan is the first page of your handout. And you can see that in July 1st, 2013, that valuation on an actuarial basis tells us that we are 1.65% deficient. And if you go over a couple columns, you'll see that on July 1st, 2012, we were 0.96% deficient. That meets the criteria of being 0.5% deficient for two consecutive years, which then requires the board to recommend up to 0.25% contribution increases for each the employee and the employer. We have to be more than 2% deficient for two consecutive years to recommend 0.5%. So we're coming in at 0.25% each. Again, as Mr. Bergstrom pointed out, if you look at the next page, our general plan has improved in its funded ratio on a market value. We are from 77.5% in 2007, when everybody was on a good path going forward, we are today about 78.3% funded. And the reason is that we got those contribution adjustments in as the economic conditions were deteriorating. Our contribution rates, however, were at the close to what they needed to be. They still need a little improvement, but this recommendation would take us a long way. The one reason we're before you today in a bill form, which you don't have in front of you right now, but I asked commission staff to draft, is that our contribution recommendation language in 353.27 says that this goes into effect July 1st. Local government said to us, said to our board, that's difficult because as cities and counties, we budget in the fall. So if you implement this July 1st, 2014, that impacts before we have budgeted for the increase. So we're also recommending that we move our effective date for any changes, this one and any that may have to happen in the future, to January 1st following the recommendation. So in terms of what it does for our plan, like Mr. Bergstrom's general plan, you can see on the next page that a contribution rate increase helps improve how quickly we're going to get to our 100% funding. Keep in mind that we are required under law to be 100% funded by 2031, and it's 2014. Every year that we get closer to that requirement, if there's any unfunded liability, the need to have the right contributions coming in to pay that off is absolutely critical, or our funding chart will go in another direction. So the contribution rate increase will, again, help keep us on that steady upward trajectory to make sure we get to that 100% measure. Okay, any questions for Ms. Fanick? Representative O'Driscoll.
Maybe just a little bit of follow-up for the commission, since we've been through so many different cycles on this. And I would, first of all, compliment Ms. Vanek on having that effective change being on January 1st, since the state's fiscal is July 1st through June 30th, having been in local government, knowing that it is difficult at times when there is something midstream that comes in, to have to deal with that in a budget when you weren't planning on that. And although, as Mr. Bergstrom pointed out, on a $50,000 employee, it's $250 times the number of positions times the entire payroll. It can be a challenge. So I appreciate and think that that's good public policy to stay fiscally in the same cycle with the local governments. The other thing that I would mention is that voluntarily coming to this commission and to the legislature was the police and fire pension plan last year. They saw that they were underfunded. They worked and came to us with a proposal last year. So I want to just make sure that we are remembering the good work that those folks had done coming to us and voluntarily bringing that. Where now MSRS and PRE General are also stepping forward to do that. So I think that's an important item that just needs to be underscored here this morning as well. Thank you. A lot of people are here for that, so I would suggest
doing that. Sorry, we're whispering back here on the schedule. Any other questions? Okay, so we'll take action on this then in the future. For sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for moving it up to
please. Thank you. I'm going to skip over number four for now and go to number five. This requires commission approval. Mr. Martin.
Members, tab five in your packets is a letter from an actuarial firm on behalf of the Chaska Fire Department. There are a small number of volunteer fire pension plans that provide monthly benefits where there's a mortality risk. Individuals, when they retire, most of our volunteer fire plans provide a lump sum benefit or a set of installment payments that has no mortality impact. But those that provide a monthly benefit or the option of a monthly benefit have a mortality risk. And this is a request to update their mortality assumption. You acted on a comparable request from the same actuarial firm back during the legislative session. This is for the Chaska Fire Department. There are, I think, seven true monthly benefit plan, volunteer fire plans, and another 15 or 16 that are combination lump sum or monthly benefit plans that are the potential universe of folks who might want to request this. So this is a pro forma circumstance. This is suggesting a change from the mortality table that used to be used by virtually all Minnesota pension plans, the 1983 group annuity mortality table, to the RP 2000 mortality table, which is the same mortality table that the statewide and major local pension funds have also gone to. So this is not a controversial item, but a pro forma item as I see it.
Any discussion?
We need a motion.
And then we need someone to offer the motion.
There's a motion on as the second page of your document, which is identical to the one you did for the prior volunteer fire plan.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'll move by LCPR 14-M1.
Is there any discussion? Anybody from the audience? Right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Mr. Dan Hannon, who is a former Minnesota Pollution Control Agency employee, just wanted to address us, I hope briefly, Mr. Hannon here, yes, on the deferred annuities augmentation changes that came to his attention, and he has some concerns about those.
I have a handout.
Okay. Well, Lisa will come and get that from you. Okay, Mr. Hannon.
Good morning. Madam Chair and Commission members, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify this morning. As indicated, I am a former state of Minnesota employee. Having worked for the MPCA, I have earned a deferred member pension benefit through the MSRS system. What I'd like to do this morning is to bring to your attention a significant reduction in my pension benefit. That reduction took place as a result of legislative action in 2010 that was necessary, of course, to preserve the pension fund caused by an economic downturn. What I'd like to do is direct your attention, if you would, to the handout I think that you received. And I'd like to share with you personally my pension benefit. There are two pages. The first one, of course, describing the annual statement as of 2009. I've taken the liberty here of highlighting the single benefit associated with that, with the associated dollar amount. The second page, of course, reflects the changes that occurred in the calculation of my benefit after the legislative session in 2010. As you can see, they significant reduction of nearly one-third of the pension benefit. My decision to leave state employment in 2000 was in part based on my pension benefit status at the time. Of course, I could not have anticipated such a reduction of nearly a third of my benefit, and as such, that will significantly impact the lifestyle that I'll be leading going into retirement. I do recognize the necessity in 2010 to adjust the benefit due to preserve the fund's financial health. However, I am disappointed about the fact that the 2010 legislative language lacked the ability to restore that pension benefit once the financial situation and the financial health of the fund returned, which it just about has at this point. I urge the Commission to consider bill language to restore the deferred member benefit to its pre-2010 levels, and to that effect, I have approached Representative Kahn and Senator Hayden to sponsor some language to do just that under Larry Martin's guidance. That's all I have this morning. Thank you for the opportunity.
Are there any questions? Okay, then maybe we'll see Mr. Hayden back with legislation. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to move now to the number six, which is the study on the consolidation of Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund Association. And why don't we have Mr. Stoffel, Mr. Doan, and Ms. Hacking come forward for that presentation.
Yeah. I think I'll
number six.
don't think I could read. My answer was you should check with the zoning legislator, which is not responsible. Is this the same thing in our packet, or is it PowerPoint?
This is the presentation.
Okay. Great. Welcome, and thank you for your work on this issue, important issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to lead off. My name is Laurie Hacking, Teachers Retirement Association, and thank you for taking time on a busy agenda to hear the final results of the study that we were mandated to do. You recall we were before you in September, I think, discussing the study and an outline that we had and the process that we were using. So we're back today to actually go over the results with you. And there'll be three of us presenting various parts of the report, and we're going to be sort of tag team. We'll be referring to this presentation that I think was just handed out. And you also have a complete copy of the full study that was delivered back in December to your offices, and looks like they're at your places as well. So turning to page 2 of our handout presentation, this report fulfills a mandate of the 2013 legislation that required the three teacher systems, that is Duluth, St. Paul, and the statewide TRA, required the boards and the staff, the directors, to develop a report to report back to you on the feasibility of consolidation. You may remember that during the debate on the 2013 legislation, both St. Paul and Duluth came forward with requests for state aid, which you did grant for 2 years. But out of that discussion, there was interest, especially on the part of the governor's office, to evaluate consolidation options. So that's why this report is before you. The report covers a number of areas, including feasibility of consolidation, what are the financial requirements. It contains detailed actuarial analysis, some fairly detailed implementation plans, a discussion about what might be involved with asset transfers from a consolidating fund into the State Board of Investment, as well as member education and communication efforts. The process that we used for developing this report is that the three directors worked on writing the report. Our boards reviewed several iterations of the report and the recommendations, and the boards eventually over the six-month period took positions and made recommendations that are in the report. We received a lot of input and contributions from the State Board of Investment, you'll see that in the report, as well as our actuaries. TRA's actuary took the lead in producing the analysis that you see in the report, but they were assisted and had input from both Siegel with the Duluth system and Gable Roeder Smith, which supports the St. Paul system. So with that as a starting point, I'm going to turn it over to Paul. We're going to go over kind of the financial status of each of our systems just as to lay the groundwork for the study.
Okay, thank you, Laurie, Madam Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Paul Doan, and I have the privilege of serving as the Executive Director of the St. Paul Teacher Retirement System. On page 3 of the report, or at least page 3 of the handout, there's a summary of the funding situation for St. Paul. I'll just highlight a couple of items here. Fiscal 2013 year, which of course ended as of June 30th of 2013, our actuary, which is Gabriel Roeder Smith, as Laurie mentioned, determined that we had a funding ratio of 64% based upon market value. I'm pleased to report that that has continued to improve. We did enjoy, as other systems did, a very positive calendar year 2013. And through the December 31st number, that market value basis has probably improved from a funding standpoint from about 64 to near a 68% at this point. And below on that page is a summary of the some selective years in terms of showing changes in that funded ratio. This funded ratio is on a market value basis, which means there will be some fluctuation in those annual reports due to the fact that it is based upon the actual value of the assets in hand, which I think is a better way over time to demonstrate the actual value and funded soundness of the system. And the chart is there for you to review. I would make one comment, and that is St. Paul is sort of a unique entity within the state's retirement systems in that there was a significant stretch of time in the late 70s through the 80s and into the middle part of the 1990s in which the state had acted to remove a certain funding mechanism that the St. Paul teachers system had enjoyed. Basically, it was an enhanced employer payment that was terminated, at least for the new coordinated plan members, when that system was started in 1978. As a result, as the notation here indicates, our system never really had the benefit of achieving the full funding levels that some of the systems in the state did achieve in the late 90s and early 2000s. The high point for our system was around 80%, and that did occur around 2000. I've gone ahead and calculated kind of the amount of money that really was lost in terms of opportunity cost had the state's contributions remained in place and for that period of time and projecting the rates of return that were received. It translates into about $300 to $350 million in additional assets that our system would have at this point in time if we had not had that funding interrupted. So I think it's important to note that while, yes, we do have a shortfall and it's a significant issue that we're in the process of addressing, much of it, if we had received those funds and enjoyed the benefits of those, would have allowed us to achieve a much higher level of funding at this point.
Mr. Doan, it would be really helpful for us if you shared those calculations with us, how you got to that. Not now, but
I'll be happy to.
Later.
Madam Chair, my name is Jay Stoffel. I'll be picking up the presentation at this point. And for 22 years, I've been introducing myself as director of the Duluth Teachers Pension Fund. Well, my status has changed. As of 3 weeks ago, I am now employed at the Teachers Retirement Association. So I'm here today to facilitate your discussion. I'll be presenting the Duluth information since I was one of the co-authors of the report and worked to put the information together in the report for the Duluth part of the presentation. So I'll be doing that today, but please understand I am currently a TRA employee, but helping you go through the going through the report from the Duluth side of the story.
Is the new Duluth director here?
She is here. My successor is Karen Kilbert, former director of the Minneapolis Teacher Fund.
And where is Karen? She's behind the poster. We can't see you. Oh, hi.
Hi.
Now I see who you are.
Madam Chair, the other thing I would point out is I know that the Duluth Board has contracted with Dave Johnson to work on the consolidation of the Duluth Fund. And if there are questions about the current Duluth Board position or any questions prospective about the Duluth situation, Dave Johnson is here as well and can answer those questions, can field those questions. But I would like to address what we developed in the report and what we're presenting today in relation to Duluth as far as the past, the current and the past. So on page 4 of the handout, another similar summary of similar to what St. Paul just presented, but of the Duluth Fund. I think the story of Duluth, many of you know, a very well-funded plan for decades over the last 40 years, typically running in the 80, 90, and even 100% funded status. But over the last several years, 15, 20 years, there's been a demographic shift in the population, in the number of students in the Independent School District 709, and that has a direct impact on the number of teachers. So we do have what we call an upside-down demographic system situation in Duluth, where we have almost twice the number of retirees as active members paying into the fund. So although we do have a very strong history, or a very long history of very strong funding, now the demographic situation following the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009 has presented some very serious challenges. So that has led the DTRFA board in December to take a position in support of merger with a TRA, given the large unfunded liability and the situation with the demographics in place in the plan. I won't belabor the statistics on the bottom of page 4. You can see the funding story after the crash of 2008 and 2009, some recovery. The real difficulty in managing a pension fund with having gone through a severe crisis like that in 08 and 09 and dealing with the demographic situation is, as all pension funds, we have continual outflow of assets. And when the recovery happens, it's really, I mean, those assets are out the door. They don't recover. And when we have a very strong or large unfunded liability and fewer contributions coming in, the recovery is just very, very difficult. A lot of assets have left during that Great Recession and aren't there to recover, and small contributions replacing that flow. So it's just a very difficult financial situation when you're dealing with a small, confined geographic area. Even having come from a very strong funding situation for decades, that economic crisis was really an overwhelming thing for the plan to deal with at this point. You can see on the next page, 5, is sort of a kind of a busy chart of the strong funding situation that the plan has been in over the last 40 years. During that 40-year period of time, 31 years were either 80% funded or stronger, 90, 100% funded, and even in surplus, 31 years out of those 40 years. So just a very strong history. And, by the way, with almost little to no state aid during the course of that 40-year period. State aid for the Duluth plan didn't exist until 1998. And there's a long history to why that happened. As I did research back in the 20s and 30s and the 40s, the early years of the plan, there was a strong focus on keeping the benefits under control. There never really was a basic plan in the Duluth Fund, basic in the sense that there were employees that were not covered by Social Security. But it did not, the old plan in those days for employees not covered by Social Security didn't have the kind of formula multiplier that existed in the basic plans for some of the other plans. It was just a more conservative benefit structure. And combined with that, the employer was always paying at least the actuarially required contribution and sometimes more. So there was a strong funding stream going into the plan in the early life of the plan, in the early decades of the 1900s, a strong employer contribution, certainly all the employee contributions, and a very conservative benefit formula, benefit structure. So that led to the history of being very well funded over the course of its life until certainly the crash of 2001 had an impact, but there was a pretty good recovery after that short market event, but the crash of 2008-2009 certainly was a bit, seems to be a bit too much to overcome. The other thing on page 6 is some actions. I guess what we're pointing out here is some of the things that the Duluth board, the members, the retirees, the board, the employer, some of the things the legislature has done to rectify the situation. So we haven't sat by idly looking at this deterioration in the condition of the plan. We all know the story of 2010, the increase in the employee contributions, the employer contributions, the retirees taking no cost of living adjustment for 3 years. That is the most severe treatment of the retirees, if you want to call it that, of all the pension funds. Some funds did suspend COLAs for 2 years. Others reduced from a 2 or a 2.5 rate to a 1 or 1.5% COLA, but the Duluth plan went to zero for 3 years. So that was the strongest reduction in cost of living adjustment of all the plans. And a lot of other things, increasing vesting to 5 years, reducing interest rates on various refunds and retiree returning to work, those kinds of accounts. And some additional things in 2013, again, increasing contribution rates and some forfeitures of those ELSA accounts, which are accounts for retirees who go back to work and exceed the earnings limitation. So with all of those things...
Mr. Stolfo, are your contribution rates now the same as TRA?
Madam Chair, yes, they will be the same. They currently are the same and will be the same. Well, let me take that back. The employer contribution rate currently is not the same, but it will be the same on July 1, 2014. So we're quickly getting in sync with the TRA. In a matter of 5 months, they will be identical. But the employee rate is currently the same at 7%. So those things have certainly helped, and we appreciate during the last session there was a $6 million appropriation for 2 fiscal years. Those things have certainly helped the plan, but it just is a lot to – there's still a lot of work to do with that plan, and the Duluth Board realizes that the answer seems now to be a merger with the TRA, and they are endorsing that plan and are supporting that legislation. There is a bill in the House that's been introduced.
Okay. Okay, Madam Chair, page slide 7 is TRA's funded status. Similarly, we too suffered from the downturn. We were as low as 60% funded back in fiscal 2009 on a market value basis, but we have improved considerably to 77% on our last valuation. We too went through the reforms of the 2010 legislation where COLAs were frozen for our retirees for 2 years and reduced going forward. There were contribution increases, both employee and employer, and there were benefit adjustments cuts that were made as well. All of that has helped a great deal, so we are in much better shape than we were. We're cautiously optimistic about the future, but our board is very closely monitoring this, and we're not totally satisfied with where we are financially, and in a future year we may come with recommendations, but at this point we're just monitoring things closely. So page 8, just a brief, there's a section of the report that fairly long section that starts on page 14 of the report where we compared benefits and contributions of the three systems. And just the overall summary is that the three funds really have very substantially similar benefit structure. There is only one area where there are differences, and that has to do with the annual COLA increase for retirees. Generally, over the most recent decade, we have provided roughly the same post-retirement increases. There have been some years that one's been higher or lower, but they've been closely aligned. But for the future, St. Paul and Duluth, their law reads to provide a 1% COLA going forward, whereas TRA law provides a 2% COLA going forward. We each have triggers. You know, if we get to 90% funded in the case of TRA and Duluth, then the old law provisions kick in, a higher COLA. St. Paul has a more graduated approach to that. But all three of our funds are at this point fairly far away from a 90% level, that's almost a moot point to be discussing that. And as you pointed out earlier, our contribution rates among the three funds are fairly similar, with the exception that the St. Paul School District at the employer rate pays a fairly a higher rate, and that will go to 10.34 by July 1 of 2017, whereas for Duluth and TRA, our employer rate is at will be at 7.5%. So I'm going to turn it back to Paul.
Okay, thank you, Laurie. Again, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, summarize quickly the consolidation options. Again, the study called for us to analyze the efficacy of merger of the systems, and in looking at that, we looked at four existing sort of options. that reflect more or less what's happened here in the state of Minnesota. Obviously, you could remain a separate fund and opt not to go into or become part of the TRA system. That was one option, which was the option actually that St. Paul teaches, and we'll get to that in a moment, selected. The other options that existed would be a full consolidation of the assets. This would be along the lines of the Minneapolis teachers, who were fully consolidated both administratively and financially, investment-wise, into the state's system. The TRA was the administrator, and State Board of Investments handled the investment side of their portfolio. There was the examination of simply transferring the investment assets, remaining as a separate independent or separate entity to handle the administrative parts of the retirement policy. But the investment mechanisms would be turned over to the state board. This would require special legislation. We do not have that capability to move the assets directly into the combined funds. However, MSRS, Minnesota PERA, TRA are examples of systems where the investment assets are managed entirely by the state board and their combined funds, and the administrative functions are handled separately by the different entities. However, related to this was, and in our examination, was a recognition that in addition to the State Board of Investments combined fund opportunity, there was a so-called
supplemental?
The supplemental funds. Supplemental funds are an entity within the state board that allows you on a non-permanent basis to transfer assets to the state board for its management of certain categories of assets or all of the assets, depending upon the desire of the transferring agency. Our board considered that and has, in fact, agreed to begin a systematic transfer of some of its investment assets on a cost-saving basis to the state board, and we'll be working with the state board to facilitate that directive from St. Paul Board of Trustees.
And you don't need legislation for that?
We don't need, no. You can move into the supplemental funds without any authorization. That's a sort of blanket existing operation. It's only getting into the combined fund. And the main difference, for your information, is the combined fund has a element called the alternatives section, which involves a long-term commitment financially into those investments such as venture capital, private equity, real estate, and so forth. And where being part of the supplemental funds does not require a permanent transfer, if you were to go into the supplemental funds and then decide to leave, you would potentially be abandoning a commitment on a longer-term funding basis, such as the case would be in private equity, venture capital, or real estate, which is often a 3, 5, 10-year lockup period. So those are not available in the supplemental funds, but are available in the combined fund. So for that reason, our board sees some advantages in moving some of our more liquid assets into the state board for its management of the investments and the dollar savings that will result. At some point, if it desired to seek the entire combined fund, it would come back to the legislature for that authorization. And the other option that existed that we examined was the sort of MRF model, where the financing mechanism was less clear. As a result, the administrative functions were passed, in this case, MRF to the PERA system, but were kept in segregated accounts, both financially and administratively. And so the financial commitment remains with the MRF organization, and the administrative portion was passed on to PERA. So in this report, you'll see that we examined that opportunity as well, and it's dealt with in page 63 of the TRA's recommendation. So upon examining all of those factors, and I think it's important to note that St. Paul in its statute has obligations to three entities, really, the members of its system, the City of St. Paul and the school district that's represented in the City of St. Paul, and the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota. And in that regard, The board considered its fiduciary responsibilities to all three of those entities in examining the merits, looking at the all aspects of this merger, and in its view, felt that assuming that the state would continue to finance and provide the assistance that it's provided for this year and for next year, that $7 million that was requested, that the board would prefer to remain a separate system of the options that were available. There's a justification for that. Pages 59, 60, 61 of your report cover the reasonings behind the board in its thinking. But primarily, I'll just mention in summary, we felt as though, and the board felt as though, that from a fiduciary standpoint, the assumptions that we are operating under are ones that we feel are more fiduciarily responsible in terms of costs to the system. And as a result, our desire is to maintain those assumptions. And the second item was simply the cost that was factored into the merger of systems as determined by the actuary for TRA. We believe, based upon our actuarial studies, that we can continue with this additional state assistance to meet our obligations at a substantially lower rate of return than would be factored in if we were to come to all the assumptions required under the TRA system. So for that and several other reasons that are explained in the report, which I'd be happy to outline if there were questions on those, but for those reasons, the board has adopted the position to remain as a separate entity and not merge with TRA. There is on page 11 a chart that will diagram our actuary's projections as to the outlying progress anticipated if we are successful in meeting our assumptions and if we are able to receive the additional state assistance. The two lines reflect if we were to achieve the $7 million annually as requested, and we have legislation in to continue that after 2015. That's the blue line. The green line shows the funding progress projected if we meet our assumptions but only end up receiving the assistance that's already been approved by the legislature, which was $7 million for fiscal 14 and $7 million for fiscal 15.
Madam Chair, I'll pick up again on page 12 of the handout. And I summarized this previously, but again, the board of the Duluth plan believes it's in the best interest of the retirees, the members, to pursue a full consolidation with the TRA, full in the sense that it's a complete merger, not a standalone fund, but a complete merger of the Duluth plan into the TRA. And we actually have a House bill, House File 1951, which would accomplish that merger with a deadline of June 30th, 2015. We have carefully studied a systematic and careful and thoughtful process for making the consolidation work for the staff of the Duluth plan and the staff of the TRA and the members of those organizations. And it would really the merger would occur in two phases. The first part would be the transfer of the assets. If you remember, the Duluth plan merger manages its investment portfolio separately from the State Board of Investment, so it hires and retains its own consultants and investment managers. But the first step of the consolidation process would be a merger of the investments from the Duluth plan into the State Board of Investment no later than December 31st of this year. So that would be the first step that would happen. Assuming the bill passes, that gives us roughly 6 or 7 months to accomplish a merger of the assets. So that would happen December 31st, 2014, and then a complete full merger of the rest of the administrative functions as of June 30th, 2015. And in the report, We have a very well thought through process. It's broken out quarter by calendar of what needs to happen as far as member records and everything from the administration of the plan separately in Duluth to merging it into the operational administrative operations of the TRA. So the staff of the TRA visited the office of the Duluth Teachers Pension Fund and I think was surprised or impressed at least by the sophistication of our systems. It is a very well-run and sophisticated record-keeping system. It's basically all electronic. There are some paper records, but it is a well-managed system, and that will help. I think the staff put together a very thoughtful process of making the merger as seamless as possible. And it gets difficult, it gets complicated. Members get concerned, retirees get concerned, so there's a lot of attention on this in Duluth, and people calling, wondering about their benefits, if they're going to be reduced or stay the same, or what might be the case. So there is a lot of attention to this, so we really are trying to be careful about how this is handled with member outreach, and of course the staff of the organizations are involved in all this as well. There are some graphs on page 13 and 14. I won't go through them too much. They're, I think the picture says 1,000 words, and you can see on page 13 is the pretty significant shift of active versus retirees. The blue line is the number of active members of the Duluth plan, steadily declining, and the red line is the increasing number of retirees in the plan. So that's the graph on page 13. And there's a number of reasons. I think the population in Duluth certainly isn't growing, and it's aging. While it stays at the same number, it's an aging population. There were some legal things that happened, some legislative changes that occurred during the recent years that pulled charter schools out of the Duluth system, out of the Duluth pension plan, into the TRA in 2002. And in 1995, the MNSCU members in the Duluth plan were shifted to either TRA or IRAP. So a few legislative changes. That's not the most significant thing, but those work to compound the demographic problem. I think if you know a little bit about the Duluth politics, there were some changes made by the school board that maybe took some students out of the Duluth schools and into some surrounding areas. There was a bond referendum a bond issuance that didn't get a referendum, and some closings of schools, and it was a very difficult time in the last 5 or 6, 7 years in Duluth. And some people, I think, took students out of the system to some surrounding areas. So a lot of things happening to cause the situation that you see on page 13. And page 14 is really kind of the same information, but the very top line on page 14 is the number of students. So it's the scale is different. Page 13 is a scale that shows the lines with a larger deviation just because the scale is different. But when you add the number of students, 14,000 students at the beginning of the chart in 1993 to less than 9,000 students today, that's a dramatic shift in the number of students, therefore the number of teachers, the number of school buildings. A lot of changes happening in the Duluth school system. So, and therefore leading to the discussion of this consolidation with the TRA.
Okay, Ms. Hacking.
Slide 15 it starts at the discussion about what our TRA board's recommendations are. We basically have taken the position that we're willing to accept the financial and administrative responsibilities of merging Duluth and St. Paul, if they wished it, into TRA, but with the condition that sufficient financial assistance be provided to us through ongoing annual payments that are sufficient to fully fund the merging fund. And this would require redirecting to TRA all of the annual state aid that's currently being provided to the merging fund, plus some additional financial assistance, which I'm going to detail in a moment. The reason we're requesting this level, a fully funded level, it's really to protect our assets and assure that the TRA is not subsidizing the merging fund. This practice is very consistent with what you have done in prior years, certainly with respect to the Minneapolis teachers consolidation, and I believe also that's the rough configuration for MRF and some of the other funds that have been consolidated. When I say we're asking for full funding, what the way it's actually carried out is to say that emerging fund would not increase the unfunded liability of TRA and would not decrease our funded ratio. Page 16, I'm going to start to kind of go over some of our rationale. Anything less than a full funding level really would entail our subsidizing the merging fund, and it would mean that TRA members as well as our sponsoring employers, the school districts, and the rest of the state would be subsidizing the merging fund. You may recall that when Minneapolis was consolidated in 2006, there was a lot of controversy about this. We, TRA, were able to dispel some of that controversy by explaining that, in fact, the state and the city and the school district of Minneapolis were putting up sufficient funds into the future to take care of those liabilities. There were a lot of concerns at that point by some of our stakeholder groups about merger, and again, we were able to answer those concerns and silence the negative opinion as best we could by pointing out how Minneapolis was being paid for over many years, 30 years. Just to explain, TRA, by taking in emerging fund, we're taking in liabilities immediately, and we're really asking the state to pay off those liabilities over our remaining amortization period, which is 24 years for TRA out to 2037. By having and asking the state to pay off this liability over a period of years, there are risks involved. The first risk is that the state may decide to not honor its commitment in some future year, and actually we had a little bit of a brush with that with respect to the Minneapolis aid. There was in one year an attempt to reduce that amount, but we were able to work with legislators to make sure the amount was continued at the original level. There's also a very substantial risk of adverse experience, particularly investment performance, and we've seen that in spades in the last few years because of the downturn in the market that really has affected the assets available to pay for these merging funds. And so because it's over a 24-year period that this is being financed, there's a lot of risk of uncertainty of investment performance and other adverse experience, actuarial experience, such as mortality, salary growth, et cetera. So that's significant. There's also the possibility you've been discussing whether the interest rate assumption which we are currently at 8.5%, whether that should be lowered permanently. If that were lowered, that would also increase the liabilities associated with emerging funds. So these are substantial risks, and that is just one additional reason why we feel the full funding level that we're asking for is what we need. So to get down to specifics on slide 17, with respect to Duluth, our actuary has calculated that we would need $14.7 million in additional annual assistance to bring about merger. And on the table on that page, we kind of break that out. $6 million of that $14.7 million is the annual aid that you have allocated for 2 years.
Combining them.
And we would be assuming requesting that $6 million be continued. Then in addition to that $6 million, there would be another $8.7 million, roughly, of additional aid to bring Duluth in at that fully funded level. So in total, that is $14.7 million. Again, I would reiterate the annual amounts need to be paid throughout TRA's existing 24-year amortization period. That is at least the assumption on which we base this. In addition to that $14.7 million, Duluth is currently receiving a little over $555,000 in other types of aid, amortization aid and some other special aid, and we are assuming that will be redirected to TRA in the future. Again, this is the same, should I say, blueprint or recipe that was used when Minneapolis Teachers was consolidated into TRA, and we are replicating that approach here in what we are asking for with respect to Duluth. And then Jay has already kind of gone over this, but we do have a fairly detailed implementation plan that's in the report, starting on page 65, I believe, and we've gone through in a fairly detailed manner, tried to identify the various tasks that need to be accomplished and provided a timeline for how that would be carried out. So with that, I think we're done and would answer any questions.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hacking, do all the actuaries and do all the plans agree on all the numbers that are in the study and in the summary?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, the TRA actuary took the lead in producing this. We, in doing this, however, they the draft of what you see in the report was vetted with all the other actuaries involved, and there was no disagreement about the accuracy of the numbers. What our actuary had to do was really replicate the liabilities for both Duluth and St. Paul in order to do the calculations that are contained in this report. So we were careful to make sure that that was accurate. And so I don't believe there was any disagreement about the numbers. There's always – things aren't exactly the same, but they are – I believe the other actuaries would say that they're reasonable and there were no objections or, shall we say, dissenting reports from the other actuaries about what is in here.
And –
Representative Murphy.
And was there agreement on the methodology that was used to reach the individual numbers?
The methodology, Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, the methodology was really set out by the TRA board by stating that the financial assistance needed, it would be 100% full funding using the Minneapolis. So I don't think that the other actuaries opined upon that. That's a policy decision of whether it's 100% or something different from that. So I believe the actuary carried out what the TRA board felt was important, which is to insist on full funding, and that's how the numbers flowed from that.
Representative Benson. Someone else want to comment?
Madam Chair, I was just going to piggyback on the last question. The methodology also was required in state law. The actuarial assumptions that we had to use were really dictated in state law. The mandate to do the study assumes that we're using the same assumptions that we're using for the regular annual valuations. There was testimony yesterday about the cost being higher for Duluth. Well, you can use all kinds of different assumptions and methodologies, but we were required by the law when the mandate was laid out to use the same kind of actuarial assumptions that we use in the course of the regular valuation. So that's what we did. So it's not just it's the 100% funding. It's also the actuarial methods, the assumptions, and so forth were all dictated by law.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll limit my questions to the topic at hand, but I would make an observation that, going back to the previous discussion, I can't think of a more glaring example of why we need to look at alternatives going forward rather than sticking with what we have. And I appreciate the work that's been done. I know this is an outgrowth of, I think, some comments that were made before the legislation was passed and where we arrived at, the $7 million being given. In one case, each year in order to help, that we commence a study to make sure that, going forward, what is the right thing to do. But honestly, folks, before we make a marriage between the Titanic and the Edmund Fitzgerald, I would like to see numbers regarding what this all looks like before the state steps in if we merge the two. I mean, I'm looking at, some funding levels that should be scary to everybody. But I would like to see the actual impact of marrying the two before we actually add any state money and to know exactly what we're getting into in that respect. And just a comment on St. Paul. You know, St. Paul, and, you know, I appreciate the fact that you believe that you can go it alone, you know, but, you know, just looking at some numbers, your actual medium income is going down in the city. Your growth rate in terms of population is not consistent, or it's not keeping up with both the state and the national average. Demographics, you're getting older, like Duluth. Are all these factors being taken into account before you make a decision not to join?
Madam Chairman, Representative Benson, those factors, the answer is yes. The board analyzed the situation. The belief is that the St. Paul situation is a stable situation as opposed to the situation in Duluth. In terms of ages and salary levels and so forth, those are all part of the actuarial calculations that are put into every valuation that the board approves and reviews. So the answer is yes. We do base it upon what we believe to be the most accurate assessment of the situation, both presently and prospectively.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up. Just an observation, though. I mean, in your graph, what you're essentially saying is that you'll be back here next year looking for an extension of that $7 million for another 22 years.
Mr. Doan, do you know what
actually,
he means?
Actually, you're not quite right. We're back today.
Yeah, okay. thank you. I appreciate that clarification, and now I have an even better understanding. You know, so you're back looking for the $7 million we gave both years, but in order to make this work and to stay out of this being combined, you're still going to need $7 million for 20 plus more years,
as opposed to $45 million with the merger.
Yeah,
I'm with the 45.
Mr. Dunn.
Madam Chairman, Representative Benson, when we came to the legislature last year and asked for that $7 million additional appropriation, it was with the expectation that it would be on a continuing basis until we achieved funding or full funding or approach that level, or the 25 years, as the case may be. The legislature determined that at this point it made more sense to analyze the costs and merits of merging. So I assume that the rationale was that we will grant the $7 million annually for 2 years so that we can take that time to study the matter and then make a decision informed based upon what the report shows. So what we're attempting to do this year is simply to reinsert that original plan, which was to get the $7 million prospectively and not have it terminate after a two-year period.
No further.
And, Madam Chair, if I could...
Ms. Hacking.
Madam Chair, if I could respond to your earlier question about trying to understand what the marriage of the two systems or three systems might look like. We actually asked the actuary to do that. And on page 48 of the report, it's a very busy exhibit, but it does walk anyone who wants to go through all those numbers through an analysis of what actually merger would do financially to TRA. This exhibit, however, assumes the aid amounts that we are discussing here, in Duluth's case over $14 million, in St. Paul's case $46 million. It assumes that those amounts are in here. If they were not, obviously, it would then diminish. And if we were merged, it would diminish TRA's standing. It would diminish our funded ratio. It would increase our unfunded liability, et cetera. So the exhibit here is on the basis of showing how the aid amounts would, in a sense, sort of plug the hole that's created by merging either or both of the funds.
I'm going to ask that question.
I've already talked a little bit.
You've talked about it. Any other questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hocking was referring to, this is the same way that we did the Minneapolis program, and I guess I wasn't here at that time, so I just have a few other questions, just maybe from some backgrounding on that. In the Minneapolis teachers' pension, when it was merged into TRA, was there state direct transfer payments that were made to continue to help stabilize the introduction of the new pension, future pensionees into the plan?
Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, yes, that is the case and continues to be the case. We actually took some time to detail that in the report, what we are getting with respect to Minneapolis on an ongoing basis. It's about $66 million annually when you consider all of the amounts that are coming in. Some of that is direct state aid. Some of it is a direct payment from the city of Minneapolis. Also from the school district of Minneapolis, in other words, a direct payment. And then the school district in Minneapolis pays an extra 3.64% of payroll for every active teacher that they have. So, in other words, they pay 7.5% for the teacher who's contributing, and in addition, 3.64 on top of that. So that's another additional ongoing amount that is coming to TRA annually to help take care of the unfunded liabilities, which we took on when they were merged. And it's page 36 of the report details all the revenue sources with respect to Minneapolis, and it's about $66 million annually.
Madam Chair.
Representative Driscoll.
Just another quick follow-up just to kind of help frame this. Again, I will take a closer look at the report. Being new to the Pension Commission, there's just an awful lot to absorb. Would there be any payments that would be made in addition to, like with Minneapolis, if Duluth were to do this? And again, if they're in the report, I'll see those, just kind of wanting to look at this, or would this just be strictly the 14.7 million a year for 24 years that would be the state? Is there additional money that would be coming from Duluth to help offset or to supplement that shortfall?
Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, no, the report does not contemplate that. The $14.7 million would be essentially from the state.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could just back up that
Mr.
answer.
Starfall.
Just to clarify why that is the case, is I think the histories of the Duluth plan and the Minneapolis plan are different, and for a time, the employer share was less than required in the Minneapolis case, and the employer of record goes back in the early days to be the city of Minneapolis, and it was the school district, and it was the state of Minnesota. In Duluth, it was a different history. As I mentioned earlier, the employer share has always been paid at least the amount that the actuary was recommending, sometimes more. So to pin an additional amount on the school district or the city of Duluth, I guess you would need to fashion some argument why that might be appropriate, but the histories wouldn't justify that sort of a financing structure.
Just real quick, and I will leave it at this, Madam Chair. Thank you for that clarification. That makes sense, that perhaps Minneapolis is funding at this level, Duluth is at this level, so to bring everybody back up to parity on that, we would need to have had some additional funds from the local, and that's plausible as to why there's a differential. Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and Ms. Hacking, when you bring another group into the TRA, are all of the members then under the same stipulations in terms of benefits, vesting, and so forth?
Ms. Hacking.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, yes. The assumption here is that if Duluth were to consolidate, they would be at the same benefit levels, same way of calculating service credit and that sort of thing as TRA. That's correct. And that was the same approach that was used in Minneapolis. There are a couple of very small provisions affecting a small number of people in Duluth that they would be grandfathered in under what's called the old plan. But essentially, the benefits and the structure would be the same.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Ms. Hacking, I'm looking at the comparisons here in your book with Duluth, St. Paul, and TRA, and I see some differences, but they would be, if they were merged in, they will be under the TRA.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, that's correct. And really, the differences, although we highlighted them, is really more for staff to understand where we've got some work to do. The only main difference is in the COLA. Otherwise, most of our benefit provisions are really very, very similar.
And Madam Chair, would that be the same? You're talking about Duluth. Would that be the same with St. Paul?
St. Paul, yes.
Thank you.
I have a question, but in interest of time, I think we need to move on to the testifiers. There are two people who wanted to testify, and that's Dick Wasco and Jan Allswiger. So if you wanted to both come forward. And while you're coming forward, it looks like our next Pension Commission meetings will be then February 12th in the afternoon and February 13th in the morning, because people had conflicts on the 11th, they told me. And we have to have a subcommittee to look at our actuarial services. The contract is up for renewal. And I'm wondering if Representative Nelson, since you were on that last time, if you would be the chair of that subcommittee. You know what I just gave you?
I guess I can do that.
I didn't run out of
the room fast enough.
And
made eye contact, Representative Nelson. You made eye contact.
Senator Rosen was on it before, so hopefully she's not here today, but hopefully she'll serve. And then could we have two other people that would volunteer, maybe a Republican from the House side and Democrat from the Senate side, between the two of you?
I nominate Benson.
He nominates O'Driscoll.
Under the
between,
bus.
Between Senator Johnson and Senator Goodwin, would one of you be willing to serve on the Actuarial Services Subcommittee?
I say something.
I think it shouldn't involve more than one meeting. What do you think?
Good advice.
One or two meetings? One or two meetings. You look at who is our current actuary, which is who?
Millman.
Millman. And see if we want to look at anyone else, like Deloitte and whoever else wants to bid, and then decide, make a recommendation between whoever's interested. All right. Senator Goodwin, and did you want to toss a coin between the two of you?
I think Tim's really, he's sold on the idea.
I sort of feel like President Johnson. If asked, I will not serve. If elected, I will not, you know. Yes. If we can reduce the amount of meetings and increase the productivity at the meetings to one or two, I'd be very happy to do that.
I'm sure that's all it would take. All right, Representative O'Driscoll. Okay, Mr. Wasco, welcome. Nice to see you.
Thank you. I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Dick Wasco. I'm a St. Paul retired teacher, and I'm a Minnesota taxpayer. Money plays a big part up here at the Capitol, and I'm hoping that we might be able to save the Minnesota taxpayers some money. First of all, I'm in favor of the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund to be consolidated with TRA. History is always can explain a few things. In about 1997... Senator Steve Morris from Caledonia, some of you may remember, tried to save the Minnesota taxpayers some money and wanted to consolidate St. Paul with TRA. We failed.
Was he chair of the Pension Commission?
97. The unfunded liability back then was in the of the TRA, I believe, was in the 90s. Today it's, 72, St. Paul was 76, now it's about 60, and Duluth was maybe 90, and now it's about 54. So I'm with the understanding that the higher it is, the less money, the lower it is, the more money the state must pay. I believe we can save some money by consolidating, and I hope we do not make the same mistake again. Why should St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund consolidate with TRA? Well, looking at the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund, employees, they have about 7. The administrative cost is $979,000. $307 per year. Now, investment costs, I don't know, but you just heard testimony saying that they would like to branch off some of the money to the state because it would save money as far as investment costs. You also just heard the three of them stole a lot of my thunder here, is that the COLA benefits, TRA is 2%, you know, at 90 goes up to 2.5% cost of living. St. Paul now is 1%, and I don't think St. Paul Fund will ever reach 80% funded, because then we would go up to 2%. You should remember this, that these increases are compounded each year. Each year they're compounded. And I'm at one less percent, or maybe even two. So I think that's, from a personal standpoint, it makes sense why we should consolidate. Why hasn't St. Paul Fund been consolidated to TRA in the past? I think, one, you know as well as I do, it's the money. And who has the money of the state? And the question is, when is it going to happen? I believe St. Paul is one of the oldest, one of the oldest, retirement funds in the state. It had a great deal of tradition. It had pride and independence. I may say step on some toes here, but they also had the Committee of Nine that many people aren't aware of. Now they call it the PAC, the Political Action Committee. The Committee of Nine contributed to the The Committee 9 has contributed deductions from payroll checks of the active and then as well as the monthly retired checks. So that was an excellent method of collecting funds for the Committee of 9. And there were other organizations that couldn't do that at one time. The Committee of Nine also gave generous political contributions to the St. Paul School Board and St. Paul senators and the representatives, as well as legislators who could help their cause. And as well, the Committee of Nine has a paid lobbyist. I think he's a nice guy. He likes history, and I like history too. But the fact remains is that they did have funds to participate and influence to keep the funds separate. There is a quick story I would like to take a minute here to. Years ago, I was testifying, and there was a St. Paul legislator that came in and was asking some questions that weren't as pertinent at the time. And the chair of that meeting was Representative Kahn. And after she took so much, she interrupted the man and said in a very loud voice, not a loud voice, but very firm voice, I should say, "Don't you understand? It is the fairness issue." And it is the fairness issue as far as I'm concerned. It's the fairness that all teachers in the state of Minnesota be treated equally. Finally, I think I should add one statement here. In the past, the state has taken care of MRF. They've taken care of Minneapolis teachers. They're on the verge of taking in the Duluth teachers. And I don't see why they don't take St. Paul at the same time. It's going to save money. You saw the piecemeal that St. Paul is asking for, a nickel here, a dime there, nickel and dime it all the way through. For what reason? It's going to happen, and why not happen? Have it happen now and save the taxpayers of Minnesota some money? I believe now is the time to consolidate the St. Paul teachers into the TRA, because the House, the Senate, and the executive branch appears to have similar thinking. And I think it is more favorable financially to have it done.
Retirees.
Again, I'm a St. Paul retired teacher, and I'm a Minnesota taxpayer. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wasko. Ms. Allschweiger.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allschweiger, Education Minnesota. The Education Minnesota Governing Board just recently adopted a position related to the consolidation issue in pension funds. And it states that Education Minnesota supports consolidating retirements with full funding from the state and no reduction of benefits for any members or retirees. So the bottom line is Education Minnesota is supporting a consolidation with TRA and Duluth, the Duluth Fund, as long as there is full funding. We are not taking any position at this time on St. Paul. The study, legislative mandate for the study required that the study define the financial and actuarial requirements for consolidation in a manner consistent with past practice that assures that the assets of the TRA are protected, the merging funds are fully funded, and that TRA is not subsidizing the merged funds. That's very, very important. It's also consistent with TRA's recommendation. And so rather than having a long conversation or a discussion about this, I think that this is a time when it's actually a win-win situation. You've got the Duluth teachers, the Duluth Fund, Education Minnesota, TRA, all in agreement that this consolidation is in the best interest of their members and the funds and actually the state. And I would remind people in closing that when the merger between the consolidation between the Minneapolis Fund and the and TRA Fund was put together, that all the parties agreed that the financial pieces had to be put in place so that there wasn't a subsidy of Minneapolis by TRA. So I think if we can get agreement with everybody, I think it will help put the funds in a better place in the future and help the Pension Commission solve some of the issues that they are dealing with.
Any questions for the witnesses? Any other comments anybody has? Anybody else in the audience who I didn't give an opportunity to testify, want to speak to us for a few minutes? Okay, then number four, we will carry over until the next meeting, and we are adjourned.